What are the sources and origins of writings like the Book of Mormon, the Quran, and the Gospel of Thomas, and how do they compare to the Bible? The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August is One Word, Many Writings, a study of the origins of religious writings. You can read an excerpt at issuesetc.org, or you can find out more about One Word, Many Writings by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. One Word, Many Writings by Dr. Adam Francisco.
No matter what we choose to believe, there's no God who condones taking the life of an innocent human being.
Where I think we are in the culture, but also with religious institutions, is that people have stopped hating us, that is to say LGBT people, but they're not yet ready to celebrate us. That's the next big work to do.
Maybe it's something as simple as you whistle while you work.
Just whistle while you work.
Mega churches are a house of cards. Mega churches really are the primary example of what's wrong with evangelicalism, why it's so thin, so insubstantial, so unsatisfying.
Southern Illinois truck drivers, love issues, etc.
There are attempts, always have been attempts, well-meaning attempts on the part of the church to unite, to come together. Now, nowadays, when we try and do this, we do it by avoiding talking about controversial doctrinal issues. That's not the way that the ancient Christians approached it. They thought that the only way to achieve true unity was to discuss those controversial issues, to take them on together, to hear both sides of the debate and to weigh both sides of the debate against Holy Scripture and the previous wise counsel of the church. Now, sometimes the best laid plans end up having the opposite effect. And in the case of some of these councils that we've been studying here in our six-part series, actually six parts so far, our weekly series on the seven ecumenical councils of the church, the result was division, for a number of reasons, rather than more unity. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Welcome back. We're coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. Thanks for tuning us in. Pastor Heath Curtis joins us as we continue our series on the seven ecumenical councils of the church. After that, we'll hear from you, our listeners, on the Issues Etc. comment line. Our call-in number for the next hour, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, or our Twitter address at issuesetc. Pastor Heath Curtis is pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Warden, Illinois, and Zion Lutheran Church in Carpenter, Illinois, author of the book Ordering Our Days in His Peace, An Introduction to the Christian Church Year. Heath, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd. Good to be here.
Talk about the way that kind of these councils, especially these latter councils of the seven, had the opposite effect in terms of uniting Christianity than they were intended, especially one like this that ends up in some real schism.
Yeah, the problem, I think, is that once again, we have outside forces operating on the church, you know, political forces. Because, you know, the politicians have a goal, and they want to meet a goal, and the tools that politicians use essentially boil down to violence. You know, one way of defining what a government is would be to say it's a geographical monopoly on violence. You know, you can't, if somebody owes, you know, you, Todd Wilkin, $20 and they won't pay, you're not allowed to go to their house with a gun and point it at them and get the money or put them in your basement until they pay up. But that's exactly what a government can do, right? If you don't pay your taxes, they can throw you in jail. So the basic tools of government are violence, and whether they use that violence justly or unjustly is where we say it's a good or a bad government. Well, since they're a one-trick pony, since they have the only tool they have is a hammer, every problem is a nail. And so every church problem for the emperors of Constantinople and now the governments, one might say, of the Western Empire, because since last we met in 451, the Western Church has fallen, and now it's a mess. And the new emperor, the very powerful, active emperor, Justinian, wants there to be unity in the East so that he can press forward with reconquering the West. Well, you know, that's not a formula for peace in the church. That's a formula for forging ahead with half-baked ideas and violence and force and ending up with more schism than you started with.
So what occasions, what are the theological issues that bring rise to the Second Council of Constantinople?
Well, it's all a hangover from Chalcedon in 451. Chalcedon, as we talked about last week, really comes out with a definition of Christology that's should be very hard to argue with. It's a very biblical definition that Jesus is really God and really man. And the sad thing about this is that you know, all Christians, all parties in this agreed to that, that Jesus really is God and man. The argument was, how do we express that? One might say that the argument was really about what a few Greek words meant. What does it mean to say that Jesus has two natures, but he's only one person? Basically, what happened after Chalcedon was some people said, well, you can't have a nature without a person. They treated those two things as synonyms. And so you had a group of Christians called the Monophysites who did not want to say Jesus has two natures, but he was one person. They wanted to say he's one nature of the Word, that with a capital W, the second person of the Trinity, and a human being. So they were confessing that Jesus was God and man, but they wanted to say that meant he has one nature, one person. On the other side were those who upheld the Council of Chalcedon's definition of the terms, saying that Jesus has two natures, one person. We need a way of talking about the fact that Jesus is really God, and we need a way of talking about the fact that Jesus is really man, and we need a way of talking about that he's not two different Jesuses, but he's one Jesus. And so they went with two natures and one person. This gets divided into, half a dozen groups by the time you get to the council, of people who have different ideas and different ways of speaking about how this should be. And so it's just, it's 100 years, really, of back and forth of different groups developing and politics playing into it, and especially imperial politics. And in the meantime, in 476, the last Roman emperor is defeated by the Germans, and most of them are Arian, and so now Arianism is back. To say that this century is a mess would be an understatement.
Now, there's a term here used with respect to the Second Council of Constantinople, three chapters. I understand that Justinian, the emperor, takes a view on these things, hoping to win over one side of the debate. What happened?
Right. You have imagine this. Imagine that you live a good Christian life. You're a theologian, and you're well respected in your time period, and you're laid to rest with your fathers in a church funeral, and then 100 years later, somebody wants to condemn you for heresy. Now, it seems kind of silly, and this was the deal with the three chapters. There were three theologians, the chief of which is Theodore of Mopsuestia, but the others were Theodoret of Cyrus and Ibas of Edessa, these great names. And these were all guys who lived in Syria. And they were great theologians in their day. They're all buried in communion with the church. But they could certainly be read in such a way that they leaned toward Nestorianism, that they leaned toward really putting too much of a division between Jesus' humanity and Jesus' divinity. And the Emperor Justinian's idea is, well, if I condemn these guys posthumously, maybe that will make the Monophysites in Egypt, essentially, maybe that will make them happy enough, maybe that will make them see that we who are following the way the Council of Chalcedon talked in 451, maybe they'll see then, the Monophysites will see, that we Chalcedonians are not dividing Jesus in two, and that this will be an easy way to do things. Of course, I've already hinted at the problem with this, and that is that upsetting the apple cart 100 years after somebody's dead kind of sets a bad precedent. because, you know, it's literally, you know, looking for problems in the past. And, I mean, eventually the three chapters is approved, and we can think of it what we will. And, but of course, I mean, it's a really ham-fisted way of trying to appease a certain group in the church. You know, it would have been probably a better idea to simply invite them to the table and discuss the issues and hopefully be able to convince both sides to perhaps move away from their set formula and iron out a manner of speaking that could come across with the Orthodox doctrine, but in a way that everybody could agree to say it.
Well, with about a minute here before we take a break, what role did Pope Vigilius, what role did he play in all of this and kind of making the matters worse?
Well, this is very interesting. You know, he's on the lam from Italy because Italy is being racked by war. You know, that we're about 70 years into the domination of the Germans, even in the very heart of the Italian peninsula. So he's on the run, and he refuses to come to the council, even though he's living in Constantinople. And so you have something very interesting for the development of the papacy. You have a council basically excommunicating the pope, that they order, the council fathers order that his name be removed from the diptychs. This is kind of the official way of saying to a bishop, you know, you are out of fellowship with us. We're not even going to pray for you at Sunday church. And so it's a very interesting chapter, as all these ecumenical councils have been. They've said interesting things about how the papacy is viewed. It's through these centuries, and especially the half century after this council, where the papacy is going to make a real grab for power, and this is the council pushing back.
We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. Pastor Heath Curtis is our guest, part six of our weekly series on the seven ecumenical councils.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to 8th grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151 or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The Virtual Organist Service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
Christological, creedal, confessional. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. is listener supported. That means we rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the logo for the Issues Etc. Journal and Weekly Bulletin insert at issuesetc.org and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. Issuesetc.org, look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo, and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August is a simple primer on the sacred writings of every major world religion and a comparison and contrast of those various writings, their sources, their origins, their reliability against that of Holy Scripture, the Old and New Testament. It's called One Word, Many Writings, A Study of the Origins of Religious Writings. It covers Buddhism and Hinduism and Confucianism. Those are the ones that we're not as familiar with. It covers Jehovah's Witness, Scientology, Mormonism, kind of the strange things that we encounter in our world today. And it covers Judaism and Christianity, and it also covers Islam. All of them have holy writings, and all of them can be compared and contrasted with one another. That's what Dr. Adam Francisco does in this book, One Word, Many Writings. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and order One Word, Many Writings, A Study of the Origins of Religious Writings, The Issues Etc., Book of the Month for August, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Pastor Heath Curtis is our guest. He's author of the book Ordering Our Days in His Peace, and we're talking about the Second Council of Constantinople, which would take us up to Council 5, I believe, in the seven ecumenical councils. Pastor Curtis, we talked before the break about the Pope, about Pope Vigilius. What did it mean to be Pope in the 6th century?
Well, that was a very good question. Since at least, let's say, Pope Leo, who we met last time in Chalcedon, but certainly popes before that as well, the papacy has, the Bishop of Rome, the head pastor of the city of Rome, has tried to draw more and more power to himself. There's no doubt that as the church developed in the centuries after the apostles, that certain sees, they're called, certain bishoprics, certain cities, basically, the head clergymen of certain cities, get a lot of authority. And in a way, that makes sense. I mean, there has to be a place the buck stops. You know, in the denomination you and I belong to, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, we have district presidents, we call them. Other denominations call them bishops or head elders or the head of the presbytery or whatever the case may be. You got to have a place where the buck stops so that if there's a disagreement between two churches, between two pastors, there's someone to appeal it to. So that makes sense. But you go too far when you begin to say, now I have this authority by divine right, that God has given me this authority. This is not just a human arrangement, but I wield the power of God in this. And then when you take it even a step further and say, I am the chief teacher in the church, I am always right, I am infallible, I can never be wrong, now you're light years away from the New Testament foundation. And really, that's a development that isn't fully completed until the year 1870. You know, papal infallibility is not officially declared by the Roman Church until the year 1870. So at the Reformation, for example, it was very much an open doctrine, something to be debated. And certainly is, and at this point in history, 553, we're nowhere near getting to that line. What we have now is the Pope and the papacy still seeking to gain more and more power. And to give you an idea of how kind of silly the Roman Catholic claim for the papacy is, just a quarter century before this council, you have Pope John sent as an errand boy by the new king in Rome, the Visigothic king Theodoric, who is an Arian. He is an Arian. His Visigothic hordes are Arian. They've invaded Italy. And he orders the Pope to go to Constantinople to cut a deal with the Eastern Emperor to protect Arian churches. And so here's the supposedly infallible Pope on an errand for a heretic king to protect heretics, and I mean it's just inconceivable that this is the picture of the fairy tale picture of the Roman Catholic doctrine of the papacy striding through history as the infallible teacher, you know, the successor of Peter, and then of course Vigilius here is excommunicated by the council because he refuses the council's summons to come and help them face this problem of monophysitism. So what does it mean to be the Pope in the 6th century? Well, it means that you are the kind of guy who is claiming to be the chief teacher in the church, that nothing can get done with you, without you, and yet you're also at the same time being ordered around by Arian Visigothic kings and pouting in your chamber because the council is meeting without you. So it's all those and many other things.
It does sound like our district presidents.
Yeah.
In fact. But in time, Vigilius actually concedes to the at least the edict of the council. I mean, he obviously doesn't like being excommunicated, but does he eventually submit to the council's edicts?
Yeah, I mean, the council does a good job as far as it goes. You know, it's kind of the same thing we've said about many of these councils. The council declares correct doctrine. But whether or not the way they went about it was good for the peace of the church, you know, that's the open question. But they condemn monophysitism. They're going to stick with the language of one person and two natures, and there's nothing wrong with that language. And certainly the monophysites were being just as dogmatic and silly about sticking to their terms as you could say anybody on the other side was. And you can say that the people on the Chalcedonian side were really willing to make a lot of concessions. And so we can, if we've got to assign good guy and bad guy titles, I think we can say the Chalcedonians were the good guys and the Monophysites were the bad guys. But it's certainly another unfortunate chapter in the church's history of debate.
Where would you put this? Because we're kind of headed toward the 11th century, where there will be schism between East and West, but it's already brewing here, obviously, as early as the 6th century, if not earlier. Where would you put us on the kind of bending and breaking that would eventually come to be known as the Great Schism here in the 6th century?
Well, we're kind of at a fulcrum where we're going to turn toward greater unity simply through the great efforts of Justinian. Justinian is the towering last best hope of a united civilization, united Roman civilization. He's an Eastern emperor. He reconquers basically all the old African provinces and Pannonia. You know, he's just about reunites East and West, but runs out of steam. But he's the last great hope. Because after this, by the next council, while everybody's efforts in the Roman world are looking to the Parthians, Iranians, Persians, as the big enemy, and looking north to the Germanic tribes and these Aryan Germanic tribes, they're the big enemy. From a blind spot, out of nowhere, out of the deserts of the south, the whirlwind of Muhammad and Islam is going to race up through the Middle East, across Africa, through the Pyrenees, up across the Straits of Gibraltar into Spain, up to the Pyrenees, and suddenly more than half the territory, Christian territory in the world, is going to be overrun by Islamic hordes, and this is going to change the way the church operates in a major way.
So as schismatic as the results of the Second Council of Constantinople are, and as messy as it was, albeit good in its theology, this is in fact the calm before the storm.
Exactly. Yeah, and it really points out the political failings of the church. Because remember, there are no Arian Visigothic hordes without Arianism being supported by a branch of the Roman government back in the 4th century. And there's no Arians being supported by a branch of the royal family back in the 4th century if the church says no thank you to the emperor getting involved in internal church affairs to begin with. And so they sowed the wind and they're reaping the whirlwind. Now the whole church is divided between Arian, Monophysite, Chalcedonian, etc., and so forth, and that division is certainly going to play into the successes of the Islamic hordes in the 7th century.
So with only about 30 seconds here, next time we'll be talking about that Third Council of Constantinople that takes us almost to the end of the 7th century. what's in store for us. About 30 seconds to a minute.
You know, almost a replay. It's still hashing out stuff from Chalcedon. What does it mean to say that Jesus is really God and really man? And does any part of the Son of God kind of replace part of what a human being normally is? And it's just rehash. The most interesting thing, though, will be who shows up? What does the world look like after those Islamic conquests in the 630s, 40s, 50s, and 60s?
Pastor Heath Curtis is pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Warden, Illinois, and Zion Lutheran Church in Carpenter, Illinois. He's author of the book Ordering Our Days in His Peace, an introduction to the Christian church year. Heath, thank you very much for your time. Look forward to next time.
All right, Todd, thank you.
When we come back, we've got Issues Etc. comment line straight ahead. You call, you have questions and comments as you listen to this program, either live or on demand. The Issues Etc. comment line is always there to take the question, the comment, the criticism, the show suggestion, 618-223-8382. The comment line is full, and we've got time here on this Monday afternoon to respond to as many comments as we can get to in the next half hour. 618-223-8382. It's open and ready for your questions and comments 24/7. The Issues Etc. comment line. Your comments, our response, next. We're joined now by listener Rocky. Rocky, tell us about the tax benefits of donating stocks to Issues Etc.
What we discovered in talking with our tax people and our stock advisors is that it would be beneficial for us to be giving our charitable donations by this means, by giving stocks, which meant that we could give a stock and essentially say if you gave a $100 stock, it's straight money to whatever charitable organization you want to give, as opposed to cashing it out, we'd only be able to give whatever portion was left over after the tax consequences.
How would you advise our listeners if they're interested in donating stocks, bonds, or mutual funds?
They need to go and talk to their stockbroker or the tax person, and I think they'll find out it makes a heck of a lot of economic sense. And you're much better steward with your money, because what you're ending up doing is stretching the dollars that you're able to give donation-wise, and you're able to give a whole lot more directly to those people that you want to support, and you're able to preserve much more for yourself using the laws that have been provided for it.
Rocky, is there anything that we left out that you want to tell our listeners?
Well, the only thing that you've missed is that people really need to support Issues Etc. This is a terrific way to do it in a very economical way. It's a way to do it and be good stewards of the resources that God has blessed people with. And I would encourage everyone to support Issues Etc. in every possible way that they can. And if this is available to them, I'd encourage them to look into it, because it not only will help them, but it'll help Issues Etc. also.
To find out how to reduce your tax burden and support this worldwide outreach by donating stocks, bonds, or mutual funds, talk to your stockbroker or tax advisor, and then call Craig here at Lutheran Public Radio, 618-223-8385.
Sacramental, historical, liturgical. You're listening to Issues Etc.
At steadfastlutherans.org, we've been called contentious. We've even been called the brothers of John the curmudgeon, and we may well be curmudgeonly sometimes. But we always have the best and clearest voices in confessional Lutheranism. Articles from Molly Hemingway, Martin Nolan, Clement Preuss, Todd Wilkin, and a host of regular contributors. Come check out the new Lutheran media. Always clear, always concise, always confessionally Lutheran. SteadfastLutherans.org.
Pastor Todd, I downloaded your Issues Etc. app for my Android phone, and I listen to it while I'm on the treadmill.
You can listen to Issues Etc. live or on demand with the new Issues Etc. Android or iPhone app. You can download these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. Download an app today.
My new Adam really enjoys the app while I'm on the treadmill.